You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Hello, Grant. And now, being the second Wednesday of the month between 1 and 2, we have our friends in from Hutchinson Legal. If you've got any a question on law, not about a case, but a question on law, give Greg a ring in the office right now or in the next few minutes on 59615991. 59615991, and we'll can't put you to wear, but Greg will bring the question in here and we'll get them answered for you. But it's my pleasure to introduce Philip. How are you, Philip?
Morning, Alan. Or good afternoon, Alan. Yeah, I'm fine.
It's a while since I've seen you. So
it's been a long time.
You must have lost the raffle today, and they said you've got to go.
Nah, it's a pleasure to be here. And it was a lovely drive coming here, I must say. It's beautiful.
Beautiful weather.
Yeah.
Philip, we sent the people away with a question last time. There's a couple of cases floating around where a person's been committed and been sentenced and been found guilty, sentenced, and gone to prison. Now, for some reason along the line, and there are various reasons, not fresh evidence comes up. I can understand if fresh evidence comes up, you go for a retrial. But the actual evidence has been challenged. And it's not so much that the evidence is wrong. The evidence was probably right, but it came from a tainted source, we'll say. Why then? Because you're still... The person who asked the question says, well, they're still guilty because there was no doubt about the evidence. It's just now the evidence is admissible. So how can that make you innocent?
Great question. Very loaded. And there's a lot of assumptions in what you've said.
Yep.
One is that people think that the person's still guilty. Let me just say it this way. I've got to lead into this.
Yep.
I've given a lot of thought. Miscarriage of justice. Everyone understands kind of what that means.
Yep.
The law is trying to be fair to people. And I'll pose this question, Alan. What's worse, letting one innocent person go free or letting one or 100 guilty people go free? Oh, sorry, locking up an innocent person. I beg your pardon. What's worse, locking up one innocent person or letting one guilty person go free?
Now, I would say that nobody should go to jail unless they're guilty. So,
and then we could say 100. We let 100 guilty people go free. So no one likes the idea of guilty people going free.
Yep.
The whole justice system is around trying to find a system that is fair and finds the proof to put people away if they've done a crime.
Yep.
Now we have in Victoria a Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities, which is tied in with this notion of justice.
Yep.
And there's a right to a fair hearing. I'm not going to go through all that's number 24. There's quite a few of them. Yep. A right to a fair hearing when Victorians appear before a court or tribunal, whether it's a civil or criminal case, they have a right to a fair and public hearing and to have their case decided by a competent court, et cetera, et cetera. But it's the idea of a fair hearing and the notion of justice. Now, most of our criminal trials, the indictable offences, the theft, the burglaries, the murders, the manslaughter, the drug convictions, which is probably what some people are thinking of, have juries. Sometimes they're judges alone. You're innocent until proven guilty.
Yeah.
That's our cornerstone of our justice. When you're guilty, you stay guilty.
Yeah.
Until it's overturned. Now, the proof is it beyond reasonable doubt? Is there any doubt about this person being guilty? All of this question, when I was thinking about it, is really loaded with morality. It's about moral beliefs that people have.
Yep.
If you talk, to example, about Lindy Chamberlain's case, which is maybe there'll be some people listening that won't remember that one.
No, but
that started in 1980. She was convicted and finally exonerated, pardoned in 2012. That's 13 years ago, so 32 years. There's a bloke in jail, and I'll just mention his name. And by the way, these are by way of illustration. What I say is not to say they're guilty or innocent, because there'll be people still thinking today that Lindy Chamberlain was guilty. And there'll be people thinking that Mr. Farquharson, who isn't doing time at the moment, who in 2005, it's alleged, he was convicted of driving his three kids into a dam and killing them. And that went through a trial and then an appeal. So this is getting to the hub of the question. Yep. So you're guilty until you're overturned. So how do you get it overturned? Well, in his case, he went to an appeal, and the court found that something had gone wrong, didn't have a fair trial, so he was retried and he's found guilty again.
Yep.
And then he had another appeal, and that was overturned. Then he appealed to the High Court, and that didn't succeed. So he's exhausted all his rights.
Yep.
And there'll be other cases of people who are doing time and have been for drug offences. We can remember, I'll call a Solicitor X,
yep,
who was a police informant,
yep,
and everybody knows that case. And there was one recently in the papers about somebody who was let on bail,
yep,
with about 30 conditions that are really onerous,
yep,
because the judge, although he was a flight risk, thought that the case against him, yep, is... So the prospects of getting released because of his application would be fairly successful. Now, where all this is leading is this. You've got the right to a fair trial, and you've got the right to exhaust your appeals. Now, appeals can be on questions of law,
yep,
on questions of the prosecution might say that was a manifestly inadequate sentence, and the accused might say that's a manifestly excessive sentence, so they can appeal sentence, they can appeal guilt. And by the way, if people get convicted in the magistrate's court, you have the right to appeal, say, to the county court,
yep,
and have it heard again, de novo, have it new hearing, that's what, yep, it means. So when you exhaust your rights, if something comes up later that's going to... Well, let me do it this way. So in 2019, as a result of the inquiry into the police informants, yeah, the Commission of Police Informants, and also the conduct of the police, there was some new law enacted. It's probably maybe what the questioner's got in mind. There was always the law about illegally obtained evidence, tainted, right, evidence. We have metaphors. So the law is full of metaphors. And one of them is fishing expedition. You've heard of that expression?
Oh, yep.
Yeah, if you go,
yep,
on a fishing expedition, so someone, yep, issues documents to find, you know, subpoenas to find a document, that's a fishing expedition.
Yep.
Fruit of the poison. So evidence of a person who's been beaten up by the police, for example, to obtain a confession,
yep,
or has their phone illegally tapped, can be excluded, or to be excluded, but it can be excluded under this metaphor, fruit of the poison tree. But we actually have provisions in Victoria under our Evidence Act, that anything that's been improperly obtained,
yep,
any evidence been improperly obtained or illegal, can be excluded. It doesn't have to be. It can be overridden. The judge might think there's an overriding public policy reason to have this evidence in.
Yep.
It has probative value, for example. Probative, P-R-O-B-A-T-I-V-E. I was going to do word of the day. That's to do with proving something.
Yep.
So even though it's irregularly obtained or improperly obtained, does not need to be excluded, but the judge may or may not. So
it could still be included, could it, even if it was obtained, not...
It can be.
Yep.
It can be. If it's excluded, that's the end of it.
Yep.
That's never... and the,
yep,
person's getting a fair trial. But what? Let's assume that that evidence is... And one of the things the judge has to do, or some of the things, is determine what the level of... I'll take you through this.
While you do that, yeah, that's all right. I'll take a quick break.
That's all right.
I've been here before, making up my mind, halfway out the door, washing on the line. Group chat is a strong light. There's always things to do. Big call, but I just might forget I'm not with you. I'm better than before, like 85%. You're not my every thought. Maybe now and then, say yes to the invite. Replace you with a friend, 'cause I'm up for a big night that's never gonna end. Thinking of you. but got away with it. I feel sick, but I like it. A temporary hit.
Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Righto, Philip. So I had to take a little break there, but let's continue on.
Thanks,
there.
Alan.
Yeah.
So what I was saying, in Victoria, the way trials are run is run by a Criminal Procedure Act. It's all documented. And in 2019, they introduced this, largely as a result of Lawyer X and other things that police did. What it requires, so you can make a fresh appeal. So normally when you run your course, you know, you've had an appeal. Mr. Farquharson had two. Lindy Chamberlain had numerous.
Yep.
These guys that have been let off, well, mainly men, the drug dealers, et cetera, they've probably exhausted all their appeal rights.
Yep.
Some of them may have even gone to the High Court. So regime allows someone who's been in that position to have a second appeal. You've exhausted all your rights.
Yep.
And you've got to ask for permission. And first of all, the court has to, so there has to be this, what's this idea of fresh and compelling evidence. Now, I'm not using those. These are actually words that are in the legislation. So fresh evidence is, it wasn't given at the first trial.
But what if we're talking about more that this was given at the original trial, but now it shouldn't have been collected that way?
Well, okay. So this, I just wanted to point out that there's two aspects of this.
Yep.
The first one is, well, let me answer the question that you're posing.
Yep.
It was, therefore, it's going to be appealed to the next level, the Court of Appeal.
Yep.
Or it can go to the High Court if you get leave to appeal. So the presumption there is that the evidence was let in.
Yep.
An admission by the defendant.
Yep.
Or a warrant that the police executed.
Yep.
And got some evidence of drugs or other things that, you know, whatever, guns and so forth. And it turns out later that, so it's been admitted that the judge has allowed that in.
Yep.
There's no issue at that point that it's illegal or improperly obtained. But later on, or the defendant lodges an appeal within 30 days, and the judge overturns it. Now your listener's saying, "Well, I reckon he's still guilty. He just got off on a technicality."
I'm not making any comments.
I'm not having to go. This is a hypothetical person might say
yep.
this. To which my response would be, if you look at the way our justice system works and what it's meant to serve, and I go back to that fundamental moral principle, do you risk locking someone up, or what's worse, or risking someone going scot-free?
Yep.
And that's a moral issue.
Yep.
The law tries to encapture a lot of these things, but it's an imprecise science. So if you do that, and the judge on appeal, or three judges on appeal in the Court of Appeal, or even the High Court says, that was improperly obtained. The judge should not have allowed it, or he should have given a different direction to the jury, and it's excluded for that reason. So the conviction could be overturned.
All right,
you have to accept that. You say there wasn't enough. There was a doubt.
All right. So what if? And I'm going to throw this at you. So I'm committed of a crime. and I find out...
You're convicted of a crime.
Yeah, okay. So I'll put it right away from any other legal case. I'm committed of a crime. So I look at all the evidence that's coming up against me and I plead guilty because I think I've got no hope of beating this. So I plead guilty. I get 10 years or whatever it might be. Then I find that that evidence has been a bit tainted. So, but I'm still guilty because I admitted to being guilty. But how then can I get an appeal based on the fact that I plead guilty? I pleaded guilty.
Surprisingly, well, you've pleaded guilty and yep. you've been sentenced, the evidence. So there'll be some evidence read out in court.
Yep.
I wish my colleague was here today. I'm on my own, but he's the criminal. No, I don't mean he's a criminal lawyer. He's a lawyer that does criminal work.
Yep.
The court looks at all the evidence, whether it was probative, whether it was admissible. You're making an appeal. So first of all, if you've been convicted on your assumption and you've been sentenced, the only appeal you'd be making is on sentence.
Could it not against the fact that this might have been illegally obtained?
Well, takes me to what I was about to... So I think this steps into this,
yep.
this domain now.
Yep.
Because in this new regime in 2019,
yep.
I've done that appeal. Sentence is the same.
Yep.
I don't know about the illegally obtained or anything. But later on, yep. there is evidence. You find out one way or the other.
Yep.
Like they found out about Solicitor X.
Yep.
It wasn't given at the first trial, so there wasn't evidence of that.
Yep.
And it couldn't even been given at that stage. So it's evidence that's fresh in the sense that it wasn't available.
Yep.
Simpler examples are, for example, with Lindy Chamberlain.
Yep.
Just if I go back to Lindy Chamberlain and Farquharson. Lindy Chamberlain, there was evidence... prosecution evidence about the blood under the bonnet.
Yep, yep.
In the
yep.
car. Turned out years later, the science was imprecise.
Yep.
That turned out to be sound deadener. It wasn't blood at all. The holes in the matinee jacket, they thought that was a knife. It yep. turned out to be something, some other explanation. So,
yep.
And so on. We could give other instances. So it's got to be fresh evidence. It's got to be compelling. Compelling means it's reliable, it's substantial. And again, this word, highly probative. It's going to prove something.
Yep.
Now, if that happened... and you'd pleaded guilty, my view would be, well, I don't know whether you could use this one because you've been convicted for an offence.
Yep.
And you have been because there's a finding of guilt.
Yep.
Even though you admitted it, there's yep. a finding of guilt that was based on the evidence then.
Yep.
Had the prosecution run their case different, defence would have done something different.
Yep.
Might have led to a plea. So I yep. think you could rely on this. What then that does is you've got a first step is to seek leave, which is called permission.
Yep.
And then when the court hears it, did it lead to a substantial miscarriage of justice? Did it lead to a substantial yep. miscarriage? So in your case that you've said where you've pleaded guilty, the judges might still say, because the word, it's substantial.
Yep.
So we're not going to let people off on a technical. If the warrant was... incorrectly dated,
yep.
or you know, there was a misdescription of the yep. it was 5 grams of heroin, but it was really 3.
Yep.
These things might not lead to an acquittal.
Right.
So you've got a lot of steps to go through.
Yep.
You've got to show that it's new, compelling, fresh and compelling, and that it's going to lead to a substantial miscarriage of justice. Courts and recently, last week in the High Court, there was a case that decided was ruling on these provisions in South Australia.
Right.
Braun, that's a good name, isn't it? Braun and the Queen, or yep. Rex. An irregularity or an error can lead to a substantial miscarriage of justice. So I get back to my point. When you have these discussions, and if I raise, you know, hypothetical or real cases, yep. there will still be people today that say, that person's still guilty, got off on a yep. tick. This person shouldn't have been let out. Their opinions, but as far as the justice system's concerned, that person doesn't deserve to be in jail because there was a serious doubt, even if an error. Just means we've got to be more careful.
All right. We've got to take a break, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about... things in the workplace. Eh? First of all, I just want to make mention too that Leanne Patrick, one of our local singer-songwriters, has got a couple of gigs coming up. She's got one coming up tomorrow at 11 o'clock at the Upper Yarra RSL. She always does a terrific show. And then Friday night, the next day, between 5 and 8, she's at the Watts River Brewing. So should be both good shows.
Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Well, we've had a couple of, while that song was on, we had a couple of phone calls. The first one we're going to talk about in a minute. The second one thinks that the justice system should work on the basis that you're guilty until you're proved innocent. I think that might be in parts of America, if I've read rightly. Not sure either. Anyway, the other thing, the question that we do have, which is a person who just wants to know, how do you find out where the will is? You might be in the family. I mean, not every. I should declare this too. Only last week, I think, or the week before, I was out with my son, and he said to me, "Dad, you've got me as one of your executors of will." And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, how do I know where the will is?" And I said, "Good point." So I was able to tell him. But the question we've had, if the person's not still around, I mean, in my case, I'm still here and able to tell him, if the person has died, how do you go about chasing a will?
That's a really good question. One of the ways is you, and solicitors do it in the work in probate, is they advertise, they put advertisements and they do it, yep, settle and so forth. But I'm going to go back a step. It's prudent when you're making a will to let your executor know, and often it's a son or a daughter, yep, or a relative, and give them a copy. But I understand that there's times when that doesn't happen.
Well, in this case, the man who rang, that hasn't happened.
No. And presumably he's a beneficiary or someone who...
Or he could.
Let's assume that.
Yep.
You've got to ask the family, do you know if mum or dad, whoever it is, did a will? What are their lawyers? If you ask the lawyers, and you're entitled, a yep. potential beneficiary, you might be able to get those answers.
But there might be, say, in, I won't pick an area, maybe Ringwood, Lilydale, there might be 10 lawyers. You can't ring them all, can you? Or is that the only way you chase a
well, you can do that. You can hire someone to put an ad in the paper. And I don't know the conclusive answer to this one. I wish my probate colleagues were here, but,
well, look, maybe,
but I know that's some of the things that are done.
Well, maybe you could take that on notice.
Absolutely.
And get somebody to answer it next month. It as I say, in my case, my son was able to ask me and I'm still here, but this person's just rung. We want to know how you go about chasing a will that for a person who you don't know whether... I mean, my kids didn't know what solicitor my wife and I used to the to write our wills. And we've only had them updated just a few years ago, but they wouldn't know. And obviously this man that just rang us didn't know. So could you talk to the wills department and find out exactly how people go about it?
I'm happy to do that, Alan. Yeah. And hopefully I can add a few more tips for your listener.
Anyway, coming up, let's talk. There's been some chasing. Look, to the listener, I'll actually try and see if I can get a hold of Grant or somebody just as a... in the interim, just to sort of get a bit of an idea, because a month's a fair while to if you don't know where to go. So, and that's a pretty, you know, it was brought to me by my son only 2 weeks ago. Workplace, there's been a whole lot of changes to workplace from the 1st of January.
Thanks, Alan. Yes, some of the changes are from the 1st of January. We'll talk about the ones from the 1st of January. So from the 1st of January... as a result, so this is a bunch of swag of reforms that go back to August last year. This one is the one in relation to underpayments of wages,
yep.
Which is a result of some notorious cases of the chef and so on. That, yep. I can't even remember his name, but it was most people know who I mean.
Yep.
And it can be unintentional, but so this now criminalises that activity from the 1st of January, and it's an, the intentional underpayment of wages or entitlements can be a criminal offence. It doesn't include honest mistakes, so you've got to prove that.
So you'd have to prove an honest mistake, wouldn't you, rather than them take it as a right?
If you're a small business, which small business in Australia is defined as 15 employees or under,
yep.
under the Fair Work Act, they have a voluntary small business wage compliance code. It's a mouthful.
Right. Yep.
And if the employer can show they've complied with the code, then they're not going to get prosecuted. And things like it's not intentional, they've ascertained the correct rates, they've made inquiries, they've stayed up to date, they can prove they've done all that.
Right.
It might have been a bookkeeping error that one time. They've taken steps to rectify and so on. So there's a few other things. There's a code. If they adhere to the code... but that's not available for employees with employees of over 15 people.
Yep.
So that only applies to underpayments made after the 1st of January 2025.
Yep.
I'm not aware, anecdotally or through the press that I follow, the Fair Work Ombudsman, yep. the Fair Work Commission, of any actual cases where people have been prosecuted. And they can issue notices, they can fine you quite heavily. So even if... And we're talking about criminal law today a lot, but so although it's a criminal offence, potentially jailable time, but the maximum penalties are 3 times the value of the underpayment.
True.
Or the greater of that, or the relevant penalty that's in the section. And they can be tens of thousands for... companies,
yep.
and for individuals. So it can be an employer, a company, or an individual.
Sure, yep.
So that's something for people to take heed of, and you've got to be able to prove that you took reasonable steps to... But it's the ones that were just, flying in the face and not really
yep.
bothering to check. And it happens with casuals, it happens with a lot of people, but... It happened a lot with casuals. And I want to talk about some changes to the casual employment situation. So, excuse me. These changes started on the 26th of August last year. So I haven't been here for a while, so I don't know if anybody's told you about these changes. The definition of casual employees changed a little bit. I don't think it changed that much from the previous definition. They were trying to fix loopholes.
Yep.
Always trying to fix loopholes. And one of the loopholes was that under the previous definition and under the previous regime, casuals who had been there for 2 years on a systematic basis could go to the employer after that and say, I want to become permanent or part-time. But the focus was more on what your contract said, and that can be incorrect. So they've tried to tweak it a bit. There's two parts of this. One is who is a casual and how do they become permanent part-time? A permanent or
part-time.
Full-time or part-time?
Yep.
The key to it is that we all understand that a casual has no firm advance commitment. So the employer is not making a firm advance commitment to ongoing work.
Yep.
And casuals get loadings up to 25%. So they don't get
holiday pay,
all that stuff. Okay. So that's not too different, but you can imagine there'll be people listening who've got children or grandchildren, perhaps they're casuals. There's a lot of casuals in the workforce.
Yep.
There's advantages for employers. But eventually, a casual might say, well, I've been working here on a systematic basis. I've got regular hours. I'd like to become full-time. So how do they do that? So after a period, which is...
2 years.
For small business employers, it's after 12 months of employment.
Right.
And for all other employments, it's after 6 months.
I thought you said 2 years.
That was the previous.
Right.
But I've after a period of time, they go to the employer and serve a notice, and then the employer has to either agree within 21 days or give what are called reasons, operational reasons, as to why they can't put you on. So basically what the employee has to say is, I want to become permanent and I'm not a casual, not really a casual anymore.
All right, look, I'm going to take a quick break and we're back with more.
My heart.
listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Now, the you want to change something in what you said before on the 2 years and that.
Yep. That's fine. It was 2 years, and I mentioned 6 and 12 months. So for casuals who are making this application to their employer, if they've employed for at least 6 months,
yep,
for big companies or big anyone that's got more than 15 employees, but yep, small businesses, 15 and under, it's 12 months. So that's when you can do this.
It's really cut it back a lot, isn't it?
It's cut it back, yeah. Well, it's cut it back, but the idea is you've got to decide pretty quick what you want to do.
Yep.
Problem with it is, in my opinion, is that the employer can also exclude... refuse it if they've refused it in the past. So you make it the first application refused, yep, under the legislation, you can't make another one.
Well, can't you?
Or you've got to wait a long time. So I don't know what loophole they're trying to fix, but they've created more, in my opinion.
Created another one. All right. Now, also, we disconnect from work. There's been a bit of talk about that.
I wanted to mention this one very briefly because this also... started for non-small business employees. Remember, they are the ones that have more than 15 employees, a lot of people, a lot of businesses.
Oh, so it's not for everyone.
That applies to both. Yep. There's two dates. So for non-small business employers, this right to disconnect, which I'll explain in a moment, started on the 26th of August last year.
Yeah.
And for small business employers, cafes, small business, 15 and under, any business, 15 employees and under, it starts from the 26th of August this year.
This year,
so
right.
to be mindful of that.
Coming up. Yep.
All awards will now be required to include this right to disconnect. And in fact, they do now. So anybody, because we're in Victoria, we're all under awards,
yep,
one award or another. Employees will have the right to refuse contact outside working hours. So I can refuse to work outside my normal hours,
yep,
but it has to be reasonable. So it can't be unreasonable.
Yep.
What's unreasonable?
Well, who decides that?
I'll give an example. I won't talk about the cafe, I'll just talk about what I do.
Yep.
If I go on holiday, if I do, and Grant or Con, who's another partner, Con Notice, rings me and says, look, your file notes on that, you know, your handover notes, yep, are gibberish,
yep,
and where's the file and that sort of thing. I wouldn't say, look, I'm on holidays, I'm not going to answer your question. That would be unreasonable,
yep,
in my view. But if I'm asked to prepare a substantive document or a letter while I'm on leave, that could be. So
yep,
common sense. Just
we're not only talking leave, though. Are we talking Monday to Friday as well? Like you can't get a...
Yes, outside of your normal hours.
Yeah.
Yeah, when your hours stop.
Yep.
And this works in with the overtime provisions and so forth. So
yep.
If you're asked to work, and you say yeah, I'll do that, then depending on your award, you might be entitled to overtime.
Yep.
Look, that's all I wanted to mention on that. It's the Act actually says what's unreasonable, and you've got to look at all sorts of things. You know, personal circumstances. It could be family caring. I can't do it because I've got to pick up somebody, a child. That would still be a valid reason.
All right. Look, before we move on, I've just got to take another quick break, and we'll. Be back with more.
When you were young and your heart was an open book, you used to say, live and let live.
No, you did.
But if this ever changed,
live and let die.
Listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
I'm talking to Philip from Hutchison Legal. Philip, you want to tell us a bit about what's going on in the workplace?
Yes, thanks, Alan. I'd like to tell you that part of the work that we do at Hutchison Legal and what I do is... There's a lot of bankruptcy notices and bankruptcy petitions against people by the Australian Tax Office.
Yep.
I'm not making any comment about that. That's just a fact. That's what I've noticed. And this is especially relevant to people who are, there might be mums and dads, there might be people who are running small businesses, who are directors, so they've got family trusts, they've run a company. And their directors. Directors have a lot of obligations, and one of them is to pay the withholding tax for their wages, PAYG, the GST, and the super guarantee charge on their employees. And the tax office is particularly clamping down on all of that. And they have what they can do if it's not paid. So if a director is a director of a company doesn't pay, but even if they leave after that, those obligations haven't been paid for a while, and they leave thinking they're going to get out of it. It doesn't happen, and we've had cases where what the Australian Tax Office will do will serve a notice on the director, and the director will have 21 days to... That's not a bankruptcy, that's just a director penalty notice.
Yep.
And if that doesn't work out, they're prepared to have chats to you and work it out with the accountants. Normally accountants get involved. What we've seen, and I've been involved in cases where they've then issued the bankruptcy notice, which is an innocuous bit of paper, not a court document. People often ignore them. If you don't do anything within 21 days, you're deemed insolvent. And the petition is made to the Federal Circuit Court and Family Court of Australia. They're combined now.
Yep.
And they go and issue a petition. And when you get there, the court takes the view that it is not a court of debt collection. And unless you can prove them within a week or two why you're solvent, they'll bankrupt you. And and the way that we help people to avoid that is you've got to prove that you've got capacity to pay and that you can pay the debt. And in fact, if you pay the debt, there's a good likelihood you won't be bankrupt. So that's what we've been doing. But the takeaway is company directors, even if you've left the company, get advice from an accountant, a lawyer, an insolvency practitioner.
Is there a sunset clause, like once you've been gone 3 years or something, it no longer
exists? No. There's no sunset clause as far as I'm concerned. They had one case where he was being chased after 5 or 6 years after he'd been left the company.
True.
Yeah.
But not for things that happened after he left, would it? It would be things that happened when he was there.
If I had more time, I'd explain that it's quite tricky. It's for things that happen while you were there that you were aware of and then you left, and that happened afterwards as well.
Yep.
Simple example, someone becomes a director, they find that there's some debts. If they don't take proper steps to appoint an administrator or do a deal with the ATO, and then they say, look, I've had enough of this, I'm leaving the company, they can still be liable.
And that's, as you said, that's mum and dad just running a local little business.
Yes, because they're directors of their trust company, of their trust.
Certainly, and I guess in the past some directors have probably used as a way out, but if they think they're going to be safe now, it's a bit different, isn't it?
In the old days, the company was limited liability, but nowadays the tax department, there's rules that override that.
Got to go. Philip, thanks again.
Thanks,
for
Alan. It's been a pleasure.
Hutchinson Legal, and we'll be have someone from Hutchinson Legal in on the second Wednesday of, it'll be June by then. Thanks.